If another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 10th, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: investors have largely shrugged off a strong earnings season after October 14th, when big banks reported results, lifting the S&P 500 by only 1.3% since that date. Selling of shares in crypto treasury companies is hitting big-name investors and individuals who followed Evangelist into those investments. Visa and MasterCard are nearing a settlement with merchants that aims to end a 20-year-old legal dispute by lowering fees stores pay and giving them more power to reject certain credit cards. Hollywood producer Robert Simons led a group of investors to acquire a controlling stake in NSO, the company behind Pegasus spyware. BBC's director general and its head of news resigned after criticism over the editing of remarks by Trump that were included in a documentary. Deflationary measures in China eased further in October, in part thanks to stimulation from a week-long holiday and Beijing's efforts to curb excess capacity in some sectors. Predator Badlands led the domestic weekend movie box office with $40 million in ticket receipts at its debut. Chrome Hearts set a Southern California record when it paid $37.5 million to acquire the Surf Rider Hotel in Malibu. Blake Lively is seeking more than $161 million in damages from an alleged smear campaign involving It Ends With Us co-star Justin Baldoni. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. The Senate cleared a critical procedural hurdle in its drive to end the record government shutdown after Democrats provided enough votes to advance a measure designed to resolve the more than month-long impasse. Trump suggested that tariff revenue could be used to fund payments of at least $2,000 to most Americans after the Supreme Court appeared skeptical of the legality of many of his tariffs. A district court judge blocked the Trump administration's effort to deploy National Guard troops to Portland, Oregon. China put its largest and most sophisticated aircraft carrier into active service, advancing its ability to challenge U.S. power in the Asia-Pacific region and beyond. The FAA ordered all MD-11 planes temporarily grounded after the crash last week of a UPS cargo jet in Louisville, Kentucky, killed at least 14 people. Hamas returned the body of an Israeli army officer held by the militant group for more than a decade. Ukrainian strikes disrupted power and heating to two major Russian cities near the Ukrainian border. Super Typhoon Feng Wang came ashore on the Philippines, leaving at least two people dead and forcing the evacuation of more than 1 million. Died Paul Tagliabue, 84, former NFL commissioner. Lenny Wilkins, 88, NBA Hall of Famer. The picture on today's front page shows Senate Majority Leader John Thune, a Republican from South Dakota, after the chamber voted 60-40 Sunday to take up legislation ending the shutdown, and he is surrounded by reporters. The article, Deal on Shutdown Clears Hurdle. Democratic group joins Senate GOP to clinch funding, looks to vote on health care, by Siobhan Hughes, Olivia Beavers, and Anna Wild Matthews, Washington. The Senate late Sunday cleared a critical procedural hurdle in its drive to end the record-long government shutdown after Democrats provided enough votes to advance a measure designed to end the more than month-long impasse. The vote was 60-40 on a measure to take up spending legislation that required 60 votes under the Senate's filibuster procedures. 8 members of the Democratic caucus joined almost all Republicans in voting in favor, allowing the bill to move forward after more than a dozen failed votes since September. The Senate's next big step is to amend the measure and send it back to the GOP-led House, but that can't happen unless the Senate unanimously agrees to dispense with other procedural steps that would delay action. Still, Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, the number 2 Senate Democrat, joined centrist in voting for the legislation. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia, also voted in favor after winning provisions that reversed the thousands of firings of federal workers initiated by the Trump administration since the shutdown, and that forbid additional firings, at least through January 31st, when a new interim spending measure expires. The bill would also ensure back pay for federal workers after the White House had earlier called into question whether the money was guaranteed. This was the only deal on the table, said Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat from New Hampshire, who led a group of Democrats that provided the critical votes to end the shutdown. It was our best chance to reopen the government and immediately begin negotiations to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits. Earlier Sunday, the Senate Appropriations Committee released 3 full-year funding bills covering veterans programs and the construction of military housing, as well as the Agricultural Department and the legislative branch. Republicans have guaranteed a vote on extending the health care subsidies by the second week of December, Shaheen said. The 8 members of the Democratic caucus who backed the bill include mostly centrists like Shaheen, Durbin, Kaine, John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire, and Catherine Cortez Masto and Jackie Rosen of Nevada, along with Angus King, a Maine independent who caucuses with the Democrats. Any deal would still need approval in the House of Representatives, which has been out of session since September 19th. Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, has put House members on notice that he would give them 48 hours to return in the event the Senate passed a spending bill. Stock futures rose Sunday evening as the deal came together, with contracts tied to the S&P 500 up 0.5% and NASDAQ futures up 0.9%. Democrats and Republicans have been for more than a month in a standoff over health care coverage, with Democrats repeatedly blocking a GOP bill to reopen the government. Without an extension of Enhanced Affordable Care Act credits, which run roughly $30 billion a year, more than 20 million Americans are set to see increases in their insurance premiums. Open enrollment for next year started this month. Adding to the pressure was the fact that the Trump administration on Saturday told states to undo any steps they have taken to issue full federal food assistance benefits for November. The memo from the Agricultural Department came after a Supreme Court order on Friday paused a lower court order directing the Trump administration to fully fund food aid under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. SNAP benefits, which are used by about 42 million Americans, total roughly $8 billion a month. A key development that appeared to break the logjam in negotiations came when Senate Republicans proposed that some health care funding be provided directly to households rather than be used to pay for a one-year extension of enhanced subsidies. That GOP proposal involves sending federal money into flexible spending accounts instead of to insurance companies that use the money to offset the cost of premiums, so consumers pay a smaller monthly bill. The money could be used to cover deductibles and other out-of-pocket cost. Let's just move beyond our trench line and let's actually think creatively, said Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee Chairman Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, the proponent of the leading idea on the Senate floor Saturday. And can we give just a little bit to find something which actually benefits the patient, but may also get us out of this situation? The potential deal seemed to give Democrats little in exchange for voting to end the shutdown, prompting reluctance from some in the party. Markets Hold Back Rewards for Solid Earnings by Hannah Aaron Lang. American companies are turning in one of their best quarters in years. Wall Street has just shrugged. Of the 446 companies in the S&P 500 to report third quarter results so far, more than 80% of them beat analyst estimates, according to LSEG IBES data. That is the biggest crop of outperformers since the spring of 2021. But no matter how many times those analysts might have uttered the words, "great quarter, guys," in recent weeks, the message hasn't reached stock investors. The S&P 500 is only up 1.3% since October 14th, when JP Morgan Chase and other big banks kicked off the season with strong results. Furthermore, the median stock among S&P 500 companies that beat its earnings estimate bested the broader benchmark by only 0.3% in the day after it reported, according to an October 31st report from Goldman Sachs analyst. The historical average, Goldman said, was 1%. Why good earnings aren't moving the needle for investors as much as they often do has a lot to do with the market's months-long climb to records. As stocks reach new heights, the expectations for corporate results also moved higher. The market has been filled with steamroller momentum for the last 4 months, so it doesn't shock me that even surprisingly good earnings are being met with a bit of exhaustion, said Chris Crisanti, chief market strategist at MAI Capital Management. Investors, though, aren't just tired from all of that winning. Last week, concerns that tech companies were overspending on AI initiatives pulled the NASDAQ Composite Index into its biggest weekly decline since April. Surveys on consumer sentiment and job cuts gave investors new reasons to fret about the health of the overall U.S. economy. The broader S&P 500 ended the week down 1.6%. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Tech titans try to make genetically engineered babies. Silicon Valley billionaires push boundaries of reproductive genetics. By Emily Glazer, Catherine Long, and Amy Doxer Marcus. For months, a small company in San Francisco has been pursuing a secretive project, the birth of a genetically engineered baby. Backed by OpenAI chief executive Sam Altman and his husband, along with Coinbase co-founder and CEO Brian Armstrong, the startup called Preventative has been preparing what would amount to a biological first. They are working toward creating a child born from an embryo edited to prevent a hereditary disease. In recent months, executives at the company privately said a couple with a genetic disease had been identified who was interested in participating, said people familiar with the conversations. Gene editing technologies now in use for treatment after birth allow scientists to cut, edit, and insert DNA. But using the process in sperm, eggs, or embryos is more controversial and has prompted calls by scientists for a global moratorium until ethical and scientific questions get resolved. Editing genes in embryos with the intention of creating babies from them is banned in the U.S. and many countries. Hunt for antimony adds new element to trade skirmish. By John Emont. Esther, Alaska. At a mining site here, Rod Blakestad cracked open a shiny rock with his pick. He found quartz, a sign the rock may contain gold. But Blakestad, a veteran gold hunter, tossed the rock aside. He and his team of geologists were searching for something even more sought after, antimony, an obscure element widely used in the defense industry that is now at the center of the bitter U.S.-China trade fight. If we were looking for gold, we'd be high-fiving, he said. Until recently, gold miners treated antimony, which is often found in mines, as detritus, debris. But that began changing last year when China put in place heavy restrictions on antimony exports, including banning all shipments to the U.S. in December, in retaliation for restrictions Washington put on the export of American technology products to China. That is squeezing defense companies which use antimony to harden bullets and strengthen armor-penetrating projectiles. Antimony prices have quadrupled from 2 years ago, and supplies are now scarce, just as defense companies need to replenish stockpiles of armaments exhausted by the conflicts in Gaza and Ukraine. Chinese leader Xi Jinping and President Trump in October hammered out a truce in a trade war that has seen the two sides trade blows. In particular, China has choked off the supply of many critical minerals, some of which are used to make products such as cars, drones, and jet engines, in retaliation for U.S. tariffs on Chinese imports and U.S. restrictions on certain exports to China. Around 60% of the world's antimony is mined in China, with most of the rest coming from Russia, Tajikistan, and Myanmar. Under the truce, the White House said antimony shipments would resume. Beijing confirmed this on Sunday, saying it would relax its absolute ban on shipments to the U.S. for 1 year, though it has kept in place a clause restricting military end uses. Global antimony prices have remained elevated through last week. Patients have more choices to tackle high cholesterol. Researchers present latest study results of alternatives beyond statins that are on the horizon, by Betsy McKay. A statin isn't the only answer anymore to lowering cholesterol. The lipid-reducing medicines, among the most widely prescribed drugs in the U.S., have been a mainstay of heart disease prevention and treatment for decades. But they don't work for everyone and can only reduce harmful bad cholesterol so much. Now some patients have other cholesterol-busting medicines available as options, and even more alternatives are on the horizon. Certain patients already can take a twice-yearly injection sold by Novartis as Leqvio that uses an RNA-based technology, or a more frequent injection that targets a protein called PCSK9 that interferes with the body's ability to clear the bad form of cholesterol. Biotech Amgen has been doing testing to expand the use of its PCSK9 drug, Repatha, to more patients, while Merck is developing an easier-to-take pill version. Biotechs are working on therapies that are gene-editing technology to lower people's cholesterol, perhaps permanently. Ukrainian strikes disrupt power. Ukrainian strikes disrupted power and heating to two major Russian cities near the Ukrainian border, local Russian officials reported on Sunday. A drone strike temporarily caused blackouts and cut heating to parts of Voronezh, regional governor Alexander Gusev said. He said several drones were electronically jammed during the night over the city, home to just over 1 million people, sparking a fire at a local utility facility that was quickly extinguished. A missile strike late on Saturday also caused serious damage to power and heating systems, supplying the city of Belgorod with some 20,000 households affected, local officials reported. Trump suggests payouts funded by tariffs, by Elisa Lutpat. President Trump suggested tariff revenue could be used to fund payments of at least $2,000 to most Americans. Days after Supreme Court appeared skeptical of the legal backing for many of his tariffs, the president on social media Sunday lauded the revenue they have brought in and said the government would soon begin paying down the country's debt. He also said a payment of at least $2,000 would be made to everyone but high-income earners. People that are against tariffs are fools. We are now the richest, most respected country in the world with almost no inflation and a record stock market price, Trump wrote in a post on Truth Social. A dividend of at least $2,000 a person, not including high-income people, will be paid to everyone. The U.S. has collected tens of billions of dollars from tariffs, the president's signature economic policy. Trump invoked his authority under a 1970s emergency powers law to levy many of the global tariffs without Congress's approval. In arguments before the Supreme Court last week, justices expressed doubt that the president has unilateral authority to impose tariffs under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Tariffs imposed under the law amount to about 3/4 of the levies that Trump has declared so far in his second term. In a nearly 3-hour hearing, a group of small businesses and states challenged Trump's legal powers to levy those tariffs. It isn't clear when the court might rule, though it is possible a decision could come before the end of the year. New carrier boosts Beijing's navy. Xi marks latest step in his mission to modernize the country's military. By Chung Hung Wong, Singapore. China has put its largest and most sophisticated aircraft carrier into active service, boosting Beijing's quest to create a formidable ocean-going navy that can challenge U.S. power in the Asia-Pacific region and beyond. Leader Xi Jinping presided over the commissioning ceremony this week for the Fujian, the country's third aircraft carrier and the first to be fully designed and built in China. More than 2,000 personnel attended the ceremony at a naval base in Sanya on China's southern island province of Hainan, the official Xinhua news agency reported on Friday. Named after the coastal province that sits closest to Taiwan, the island democracy that Beijing claims as its territory, the Fujian features electromagnetic catapults for launching aircraft, including new early warning radar planes that China's other two carriers can't deploy. China has the world's largest navy, with more than 370 surface ships and submarines, according to Pentagon estimates, though the U.S. still operates the most aircraft carriers of any country. Since taking power in 2012, Xi has directed an ambitious effort to modernize China's military and turn it into a 21st century fighting force that can take on Western powers, particularly at sea, where Chinese forces have confronted U.S. counterparts while asserting Beijing's sovereignty claims over Taiwan and in the South China Sea. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, Trump's tariff rebate contradictions. He's floating a $2,000 rebate to blunt the harm from his border taxes. President Trump has a big tariff problem. His border taxes are raising prices on tariffed goods. They're unpopular with voters, and the Supreme Court might rule that his emergency tariffs are illegal. His latest response promised voters a $2,000 tariff rebate. That was his Hail Mary pass Sunday, as he declared on social media that people that are against tariffs are fools. He went on to promise various benefits from tariffs, including taking in trillions of dollars that will soon pay down the national debt. And the kicker, a dividend of at least $2,000 a person, not including high-income people, will be paid to everyone. This is a teaching moment for a high school logic class. Start with the contradiction that Mr. Trump can both pay a tariff rebate and pay down the national debt. The annual federal budget deficit is roughly $1.8 trillion, even with tariff revenue. So paying a rebate would add to the national debt, not reduce it. Mr. Trump's claim of a revenue benefit from tariffs also belies what his Solicitor General John Sauer told the Supreme Court on Wednesday. In arguing that tariffs aren't really taxes and are mainly a tool of foreign policy, Mr. Sauer said, "These tariffs, these policies, it is clear that these policies are most effective if nobody ever pays the tariff. If it never raises a dime of revenue, these are the most effective use of these, of this particular policy." He added later that, "So they're clearly regulatory tariffs, not taxes. They are not. They're not an exercise of the power to tax." But wait, if tariffs are most effective if no one ever pays them, then how are they going to raise the revenue Mr. Trump needs to pay those rebates? The truth is, tariffs are taxes, but Mr. Sauer didn't want to admit this, lest the court conclude that Mr. Trump is usurping a core constitutional power of Congress, which he is. Mr. Trump is essentially promising to repay Americans $2,000 of the border taxes they're paying in higher prices. But if tariffs are a free economic lunch and their benefits abound, why offer a rebate? Shouldn't voters be thrilled about tariffs even without a rebate? Mr. Trump is trying to exploit the fact that the tariff impact is dispersed across the economy, so consumers have a hard time sorting out how much those taxes contribute to which higher prices. They do know, however, that they're paying more than they used to. This is why the election exit polls last week showed people broadly disapprove of Mr. Trump's handling of inflation and the economy. Mr. Trump is trying to dull the public's tariff pain with direct payments that he can take credit for. This is a new version of the age-old income redistribution game of taxing people too much, but then trying to appease them with tax credits or one-time cash payments. Democrats do this all the time with child tax credits and other favors to special interest groups. We've advised Mr. Trump from the beginning that tariffs would do economic harm, and so they are. They're also doing political damage to the GOP, which is why he's floating rebates that contradict his other tariff claims. One other suggestion, Mr. President, it's never a good idea to call the voters fools. From the opinion pages, great inflation produced Mandani's proletariat. Unemployable college grads blame capitalism, but the real culprit is higher ed subsidies. By Alicia Finley. Palantir CEO Alex Karp attributed Zohran Mamdani's election as New York mayor to a reverse class warfare. I think the average Ivy League grad voting for this mayor is highly annoyed that their education is not that valuable. And the person down the street who knows how to drill for oil and gas, who's moved to Texas, has a more valuable profession. He has a point. Colleges are graduating a surfeit of young people who lack hard or even soft skills. Even as employers complain about a dearth of qualified workers, a growing college-educated proletariat can't find jobs they want to work. They believe their degrees aren't being adequately rewarded by the free market and blame capitalism. The real culprit is enormous government subsidization of higher education, which has distorted the labor supply. More than 7 million bachelor's degree recipients have entered the labor force since January 2020. Meanwhile, the number of workers without college degrees has declined by about 200,000, and those with associate degrees has shrunk by 1.1 million. As baby boomers and blue-collar professions retire, labor shortages are growing in industries like construction, trucking, and manufacturing. President Trump's deportations compound the problem. Nearly 50% of small business owners reported few or no qualified job applicants last month in a National Federation of Independent Business survey. Finding qualified workers is proving to be impossible, a Missouri manufacturer told the NFIB. The sentiment was echoed by a California auto shop. We need to teach the trades in high school again. Trade jobs can pay well, but there is a real shortage of people willing, able to do the job. Too many young college graduates are unemployed because they aren't willing or able to do the jobs that are available. As of October 2024, 30.4% of 20 to 29-year-olds who had earned bachelor's degrees that year weren't working, compared with 21.9% for those who had earned associate degrees during the same period, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Fortunately for many college grads, they have parents with the means to support them financially while they search for the perfect job. Young adults with lesser pedigrees may not be as picky about jobs because they can't afford to be. They will deliver packages for Amazon or man a supermarket cash register to pay their bills. Recent college grads view such drudgery as beneath them and think employers are too demanding. For Gen Zers, work is now more depressing than unemployment, read a New York Times op-ed headline last week. The entire process of getting and keeping an entry-level job has become a grueling and dehumanizing ordeal over the past decade, the author writes. Young people grouse that employers are monitoring their productivity with surveillance state technologies and expect them to do six jobs in a 40-hour work week. Heaven forfend that they be asked to complete multiple assignments in a week, like kids in grade school once were expected to do before school started banning homework. And how dare employers refuse to pay them for scrolling TikTok? It's understandable that grads might feel indignant about employer demands after having earned stellar GPAs for little effort and mediocre work. A recent Harvard report found that A's account for about 60% of grades, compared with 25% 2 decades ago. Some 80% of grades awarded at Yale in 2023 were A's or A minuses. It almost requires an effort to get a C. In a Substack essay, John Hopkins political scientist Yasha Munk observes, in one of the oldest jokes about the Soviet Union, a worker says, "We pretend to work and they pretend to pay us." To an uncomfortable degree, American universities now work in a similar fashion. Students pretend to do their work, and academics pretend to grade them. Parents and students who pay $80,000 a year expect high marks in return. Eased academic standards and resulting grade inflation recall how credit raters, which were being paid by banks, slapped AAA ratings on subprime mortgage-backed securities in the lead-up to the 2008-9 financial crisis. Markets seized up as foreclosures rose and buyers of the mortgage bonds realized they couldn't trust the ratings. Similarly, employers are figuring out high GPAs aren't a reliable indicator of merit. Even Ivy League schools are starting to worry that their top students are becoming a dime a dozen in the labor market. Inflated grades have degraded the value of college degrees, just as excessive government spending and easy monetary policy fueled inflation and eroded paychecks. Students benefited from eased standards for a time, just as homeowners did from historically low interest rates early in the pandemic. But grads overall are now worse off. Mr. Mandani's supporters are rightly angry that the value of their degrees and earnings have declined. Instead of blaming their woes on capitalism or Israel, they ought to be protesting big government and greedy colleges. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Half a century of anti-Semitism at the UN. The 1975 Zionism is Racism resolution was repealed in 1991, but its spirit is alive and well. By John Bolton. The United Nations made the worst mistake in its history 50 years ago Monday, and it still hasn't recovered. The General Assembly adopted Resolution 3379, declaring that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination. By a vote of 72 to 35, with 32 abstentions, Resolution 3379 shattered the UN's reputation across America and beyond. Spearheaded by the Soviet Union, its satellites, and anti-Western Third World countries, the Z/R resolution was intended to delegitimize the State of Israel. The same approach had been deployed at the UN against apartheid South Africa beginning in 1962 and led to economic sanctions, growing isolation, and international pressure on the white-dominated government. Traversing that same path against Israel was obviously in store. On that grim day in 1975, one display of virtue came from Daniel Patrick Monahan, the U.S. ambassador to the UN. His speech, probably the most important American statement ever made in those precincts, resounds to this day for its moral clarity and proof that America won't hesitate to speak out on its own behalf and for its allies. Some might call Monahan's remarks undiplomatic. Others say he simply told the truth. He said, "The United States rises to declare before the General Assembly of the United Nations and before the world that it does not acknowledge, it will not abide by, it will never acquiesce in this infamous act. The abomination of anti-Semitism has been given the appearance of international sanction. The General Assembly today grants symbolic amnesty and more to the murderers of 6 million European Jews." From the outset, therefore, the U.S. rejected the canard that anti-Zionism somehow isn't anti-Semitism. Resolution 3379 wasn't merely a criticism of this or that Israeli policy or action. It rejected the legitimacy of Israel's foundational concept as the homeland of the Jewish people. As to the UN's responsibility, Monahan emphasized that if there were no General Assembly, this could never have happened. Long years went by under this cloud, but as the USSR began collapsing and the Third World lost whatever coherence it ever had, demands to repeal Z/R grew. In September 1991, President George H.W. Bush told the General Assembly that imminent repeal was critical to America. "We worked relentlessly through every diplomatic channel to do so. Our stand was clear. Zionism isn't racism." On December 16, 1991, by a vote of 111 to 25, with 13 abstentions, the General Assembly revoked Resolution 3379. The Soviet Union voted to repeal the resolution it had unleashed 16 years before, one of its last acts before dissolving 2 weeks later. Then Senator Monahan and many officials and private citizens who had campaigned for this simple justice were in the General Assembly Hall. We felt vindicated, optimistic about the future of Israel in the UN system. We were wrong. Anti-Semitism masquerading as anti-Zionism became perhaps subtler, but its stench remained. its ultimate objectives unchanged. A few instances from a vast litany over the succeeding years prove the point. In 2001, at the UN's inaptly named World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa, the U.S. and Israeli delegations left the meeting to protest the reappearance of a document equaling Zionism with racism. The UN Human Rights Council was supposedly reformed in 2006, but George W. Bush, believing the reforms utterly inadequate, rejected the final plan and refused to rejoin. His reservations have been borne out by the Council's unrelenting anti-Israel exertions. Through innumerable special rapporteurs and working with many UN offices created over decades to pressure Israel, the Council annually produces more resolutions assailing Israel than the entire rest of the world. Most perversely, several UN bodies have tried to steer the International Criminal Court, touted inaccurately by its advocates as descending from the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal, to focus on Israel. Neither Israel nor the U.S. has joined the ICC. Undeterred, Israel's adversaries have evaded this mere technicality by allowing the Palestinian Authority to accede to the ICC treaty as a state, thereby conferring jurisdiction over crimes purportedly committed in the Gaza Strip. This amounts to one flight of legal fantasy after another, there being neither a Palestinian state nor defined territory. Nonetheless, publicity-hungry ICC prosecutors had the excuse they needed to launch investigations and leak accusations of improper Israeli behavior, including, incredibly, genocide. No other UN member, even among the proudly authoritarian crowd, received such condemnation and harassment. Those who wonder why, after 80 years, the UN can't get its act together need not look far for the answer. Mr. Bolton served as White House National Security Advisor 2018 to 19, Ambassador to the UN 2005 to 6, and Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs, 1989 to 93. He is author of The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir. The Pepper and Salt cartoon shows a mailman throwing letters into what appears to be a very dense bush. "We know you're in there, Mr. Simpkins. You may be off the grid, but you're not off the mailing list." Now for the comparison of rates from last week to now. Money market average yield remains the same, 0.44%. A 5-year CD annual yield remains 1.71%. A 30-year mortgage was 6.25%. Now 6.29%. A 15-year fixed mortgage was 5.67%, now 5.71%. Jumbo mortgages were 6.41%, now 6.45%. A 5-year adjustable mortgage was 5.86%, now 5.91%. A new car loan, 48 months, was 7.01%, now 6.95%. In honor of Veterans Day, November 11th, we recognize the sacrifices made by many to preserve our freedom. And here is the poem in Flanders Field and a little background about it. Before he wrote his famous poem, one of McCrae's closest friends was killed in the fighting and buried in a makeshift grave with a simple wooden cross. Wild poppies were already beginning to bloom between the crosses marking the many graves. Unable to help his friend or any of the others who had died, John McCrae gave them a voice through his poem. It was the second last poem he was to write. In Flanders Fields. In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses row on row that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Fields. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 10th, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Volunteer radio readers broadcast daily readings 24 hours a day of newspapers, magazines, books, and other printed matter to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. The Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service has broadcast almost 40 years of radio readings to those without sight. Our broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio Reading Studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call 716-821-5555.